Years ago, the British Empire extended itself around the world and rich young English boys going to rich boys' schools were left with not much to do because the firstborn inherited the estate. And they begin to spew out through the British Empire with a sense of moral duty to the world. More than anyone else, one man laid the foundation for that attitude. Very few people know that a November day, 11th, 1911, out of Hoboken, New Jersey, a SEAL train, J.P. Morgan's, was boarded by people in such mystery that set off to a mysterious meeting under assumed names with flown-in servants serving people who had code names they didn't recognize at an old gun club, Jekyll Island, off the southeast coast of America, to finally work the master plan that resulted in the international bankers of the world finally gaining a control over the most powerful nation in this world that they had sought for many years. In the wings was the German genius, Paul Warburg, who had to hide his participation because of an opposition in the U.S. Congress. The puppet to come out of that secret meeting that the world didn't find out about for years was Senator Nelson Aldridge, the namesake of Nelson Rockefeller. Of that family's fame and money, who would sell the plan to the U.S. Senate and do it in a way that was disguised as not a plan of Wall Street bankers. Now, as I have to often say, I'm not a British Israelite, as I insist we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let me quickly say, I'm not a butcher. I'm not one of those fanatical, radical writers. I just happened to be a history major, undergraduate, that stayed with it out of fascination. The international bankers don't loan to people, they loan to governments. The fathers of the scheme were the Rothschilds. As that wise old man from Jew Street in Frankfurt that set out as a coin dealer selling precious coins to royal families and built his fortune and dispersed his sons to Italy and to London and to Paris and set up the control on the governments of Europe and financed every war for years. And as the wise old mother said, when somebody said there's going to be war about something, she said, my boys won't let them. Those international bankers loan to governments, not people. Twice in America's history, under Jefferson and Jackson, we've been in the black. The real father of our country, in its basic philosophy, was Jefferson. Hamilton fought him. When Washington got out of bed with whomever he is in bed with, he fathered our country in more ways than one. Hoop-de-doo. What Jefferson feared was a national bank. He had seen it in Europe. What the financiers wanted was a pattern after the Deutsche Reichsbank of Germany. And Paul Warburg would become its architect, the German genius economist. Jefferson fought it. Jackson fought it. They never let up. One of these nights I'll be on the Federal Reserve Board, because poor old Reagan just might as well butt his head against a steel wall. The Federal Reserve Board controls the economy of this country. Neither Congress nor the President. The goal of these international bankers and financiers was to develop a national central bank controlling the money supply that had the appearance of being government controlled but was privately run and controlled. They had another name for it when they went to Jekyll Island. Knowing the opposition to a private bank, they came out with a Federal Reserve Board system. The goal of these bankers was threefold. Get off of some fixed hard money standard. Get a private control of money supply that had the appearance of being a government agency. And have the collateral for money, not gold in Fort Knox that fixed a certain value on the money supply, but government debt. If they could get a system whereby that money would be issued by this private entity under the guise of government control, the collateral for the money not being gold, I repeat, in Fort Knox, but government debt, they had fiat money. They created paper out of paper. The government goes in debt, issues bonds. Federal Reserve issues notes secured by the collateral of the government's promise to pay with all that it has. Government notes. Well, if you have your collateral based on government debt, you got to have a lot of government debt. You don't have to pile up gold anymore. You pile up government debt because that's the collateral. Even a layman can understand that. If you're issuing money, Federal Reserve notes, secured by government debt, the more government debt you got, the more money you can issue. But to pay the government debt, you got to have a source of government income. Income tax was the scheme. Though they promised no citizen would ever pay more than 5%, ever, it was unthinkable, they had to get a tax that had no ceiling. Unlimited capacity to expand taxation. So the poor dummies out there would pay the interest on government debt, and government debt pledged to Federal Reserve banks would enable issuance of fiat money secured by that paper. And once you got those two, the third objective, keep the government in more debt. And the surest way in the world to get the government in debt, welfare, government bureaucracy, government-supervised programs, government services, paying bureaucrats. If it worked for me, I'd pay them to stay home. They'd do less damage. But expand government social services, bringing great expense to government. There's two ways you get government debt: war and social services. Create panics, create depression that drives people into begging for government intervention, which expands government participation and government expense and increases welfare and wars that increase the debt. So you issue more paper fiat money secured by government debt, which you have to pay for with more taxes. And you got a round robin. The only people who get rich in the process are these international bankers. It's not supply and demand that's running money up. It's Paul Vogler and his crowd, Federal Reserve Board, that see Reaganomics as the greatest attempt in the world to play their game. And Reagan just butts his head against their humanly engineered interest rates. This dastardly plan was worked out in secret at Jekyll Island and subsequent meetings. But it didn't originate there. There are some idiots that believe there's two great conspiracies in the world. Communist conspirators, and that's the left, and fascist conspirators, obvious in their totalitarian regimes, to the right. And they totally miss the fact that there is an elitist group of international financiers and their puppets, funded educators, funded researchers, and funded ego trip characters, brain trusts that love the prominence and the money. They've been running the world for years. It's like that movie, The Formula. You ought to read the book, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. There you got the real story. The movie's kind of punk. But you that have seen the movie, The Formula, know that the Germans had enough petroleum from coal to run their whole war machine, land, sea, and air. And Standard Oil and I.G. Farben had the formula before Hitler came on the scene. And it's not all fabrication. They over-dramatize it in the movie. What happened to that formula? And in the movie, they have this egotistical old German scientist off in the hills of Switzerland or somewhere that wants to make his mark on the world. And he gives the formula to the cop if he'll publish it. And you that have seen the movie know the end of it. You ought to read I.G. Farben, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, Nobel Prize winners of that great chemical combine that got swept up in Hitler's war machine and gobbling up other chemical firms in other countries, having their champagne parties when their quotas were reached at their plant that was picked because of its proximity to the Jewish prison camp and the 3-mile run of prisoners in the snow to work that factory. And these Nobel Prize winners, some of them tried at Nuremberg, having their parties as they reached the quota, closing their eyes to what Hitler's war machine was doing. And in that book, you get the documented record of what was known to the oil combines years ago. I'll tell you the closing is. The star finally gets the formula back. What's his name? Marlon Brando. George Scott was the star, but Brando, he plays the fat old oil magnate. Has some subordinate come in and say to him, well, the Arabs say this or that, and Brando says, you don't understand, we are the Arabs, the oil company. And in the end, when he is able to, by crookedness, get that formula for oil back, he calls, or he finds out it's in his Swiss competitor's hands, he calls with his little electronic unit and makes the deal that closes the movie. They give them, I think it's 25% of their coal holdings, if they'll just hold the formula back a while, because they're in the process of buying up all the coal reserves, so when the oil runs out, they can milk with the coal the same way. Some of you that stood in lines in that engineered oil crisis, now we got a glut on the market. These elite brain trusters that sit way up here and see the world as one chessboard they can play on, they don't like disturbers like me. They control the media, take the time to check how much stock ownership it takes to control. They control by ego management of an in crowd that carp the same garbage. You've heard me say before, why is it when you turn the news media on? Once in a while I do the Mean Gene Review after they get done. They not only tell you the same thing, I'm still mad about it, insulting that poor goose. You call that news, a goose with his beak broke. I'd call it news if I could break the beak of some newsmen. They'd shut him up. Saint, you know, if you want to see the poor old ugly goose's beak broke off, and I said, have some humanity at least for this poor goose, or some goose anatomy. Show him after you fix his beak. How would you like to have your nose broke off and have the whole world look at it? Real bright news programmers. But they show it at the same time. You can't look at the same silly thing. If you try, if you don't like what you're watching on ABC and go to NBC, you'll see the same thing, same time. You can't even switch around. Like a bunch of puppets on a string, they get it from the same news source. Well, the world's been run for some years by a self-appointed money elite that are one world in philosophy, that have appointed themselves. It grows clear out. It's a what I'd call a transmutation of the old divine right of kings. It goes clear back to the rationale of the robber barons in American history, that they must be God's chosen ones to run the world, or he wouldn't have given them the money to do it. So above everybody else, they know what's best for everybody. But their strategy has been, that's why I wonder if they're not totally under the control of Satan, because that's his strategy. Their strategy has been to do it in secret. But like that scientist in the formula who wasn't willing to not let the world know and gave it to no Los Angeles cop if he'd tell the world about it. This guy Quigley, he came out of the closet. He was one of their darlings teaching at the highest universities, and he finally decided that it was time to let the world know that there was somebody running it. He shoots down the myth of the radical right, that everybody else is a communist and a creature of communism, and a myth of the communists against the right, that everybody that's against them is in the other camp, and finally lets it be known there's a group above them all that uses the communist and uses the fascist and uses everybody to achieve their self-appointed goals for the world. Because he was one of the crowd. The rat, he comes out of the closet. He feels it's time the world understand who's really been running the world. And on page 950 of his book, you know, I know, I might as well point you to it because it's hard to find. Having talked about those who put everybody in one or the other camps, he says, this myth, like all fables, that somebody is running the world, though they've had the wrong ones, he's saying, does in fact have a modicum of truth. There does exist, now just listen to him, this is, Carol Quigley, professor of history at the Foreign Service School of Georgetown University, formerly taught at Princeton and Harvard, has done research in the archives of France, Italy, and England, author of the widely praised Evolution of Civilizations, member of the editorial board of the current or of the monthly Current History, frequent lecturer and consultant for public and semi-public agencies, member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Anthropological Association, the American Economic Association, various historical associations, lecturer on Russian history at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces since 1951 and on Africa at the Brookings Institution. That outfit pawned off on America the license to steal called the latest bankruptcy law. Anything to keep welfare going, we poor dummies paying the bill, government debt going up, and their fiat money going, and interest going out of style. Lectured on many other places, including the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory, Foreign Service Institute of the State Department, and the Naval College at Norfolk, Virginia. In 1958, he was a consultant to the Congressional Select Committee, which set up the present National Space Agency. That runs up a lot of debt, too. He was collaborator in history to the Smithsonian Institution after 1957 in connection with the establishment of its new Museum of History and Technology. In the summer of 64, he went to the Navy Postgraduate School, Monterey, California, as consultant to Project Seabed, which tried to visualize what American weapon systems would be like in 12 years. Same group, by the way, over in Santa Barbara got a new constitution. They're funding to the tune of more money than I'd care to mention, which takes the Bill of Rights out. You know, gives us some privileges if we use them properly. Now, concerning a communist conspiracy that runs the world, he says this myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. They're not communists, they manage communists just like they manage everybody else. Let you think I memorized something making it up. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international network, Anglophile, of the old British Empire, which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. Now, you're never going to really appreciate this till you know this guy's doing them in. Poor old dumb Nelson Rockefeller almost came out of the closet because he wanted to be president. When they started prying into him, he lost interest. Secrecy has been their strength. You don't know how much they control through interlocking directorates. Nobody knows. And they were, you know why they're after churches? And that's the root behind it. I mean, this medium launched onto the public, a platform, God jumped ahead of the devil, preachers got on TV, and millions were suddenly flowing that they didn't control. Secret meetings of the attorney generals in San Diego in the early 1970s set up the pattern that blasted on California as the model state to take over churches under the guise of the old ancient English common law concept of the attorney general handling charitable trusts. It's killing them to see Oral haul in millions, Schuer haul in millions, other millions. It's killing them. You say, well, there's free press. They control the news. I mean, the Constitution controls the news. Everybody's free. Nobody will ever be fired from a network because he's controversial, they'll drum up a ratings argument. How many of you ever seen those homes where the ratings go? They control the major newspapers. For years, the major magazines that influence the mind. They're not communist. Lord have mercy. They use those poor dummies. Just keep them fighting among themselves, but don't let them wipe each other out and kill the goose that lays the egg. In fact, he says, do you understand? This guy was one of them, and he's blowing their cover. He's got to make his mark on the world. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, Cecil Rhodes founded that, grew out of his kindergarten that I'm going to talk about if we got a little time. The Round Table founded CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. I think it's only two of our Secretary of States in the last 20 years determining foreign policy that haven't belonged to that group. Out of CFR comes Trilateral Commission with its insanity, the dedicated purpose of which is to reduce the United States to appear one among many dependent upon the others in their one world philosophy. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I'll tell you this, they made it from both Britain and Argentina. I know of the operations of this network because I've studied it for 20 years, he says, and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. Dirty rat, they say. And he tells where it all started. You interested in this? And I've taught enough Bible all week. Lord of mercy, I've taught more Bible the last week than any other person on TV teaches in 6 months. They do a half hour a day. I don't know how many hours a week. I don't know how many. But I'm going to show you that I'm not going to go too far from the Bible here either. God's in control, I preached this morning. How do you think one world is going to come about? Who do you think's engineering all those little 666s into that computer in Brussels? Imperialism after 1870, does that date mean anything to you? How many times have you seen that middle 1800 number when God reached a certain timeliness in history? When Homer becomes historian instead of poet? When Schliemann digs in Troy? When Lollard digs in Nineveh? Imperialism after 1870 became quite different. The chief changes were it was justified on grounds of moral duty and social reform, and not as earlier, on grounds of material advantage. The man most responsible for this change was John Ruskin. I'm reading Tragedy and Hope. I tell you, if you want to read it, have at it, 1,348 pages. But like a lot of these books, just let me hunt and peck around for you. I can read it to you. Until 1870, there was no professorship of fine arts at Oxford. But in that year, thanks to the Slade bequest, somebody said to me, to get by in this world, among other things, you better subscribe to the Golden Rule. How'd that go? Gold? Yeah, whoever has the gold makes the rules. In that year, thanks to the Slade bequest, John Ruskin was named to such a chair. He hit Oxford like an earthquake. Not so much because he talked about fine arts. And I've been on this before, but it's time to pick this string up. Not so much because he talked about fine arts, but because he talked also about the empire and England's downtrodden masses. And above all, because he talked about all three of these as moral issues. Until the end of the 19th century, the poverty-stricken masses in the city of England lived in want, ignorance, and crime. Charles Dickens described that state. Ruskin spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of the privileged ruling class. You get a picture of them in that new and good movie about the runners, or the Chariots of Fire. That's the kind of schools. He told them they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline. But that this tradition could not be saved, he made debtors out of them, did not deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. Now, there's nothing in the world more devastating. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and nothing is more devastating than to add a moral or a religious justification for a man's position. He gave it to them. What they had did not deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. If this precious tradition, Ruskin taught, were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper-class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. Ruskin's message had a sensational impact. I'm looking for students like this, by the way, for God's Word. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years. Rhodes, who lived from 1853 to 1902, feverishly exploited the diamond and gold fields of South Africa, rose to be Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, contributed money to political parties, controlled parliamentary seats in both in England and in South Africa, and sought to win a strip of British territory across Africa from the Cape of Good Hope to Egypt, and to join these two extremes together with a telegraph line and ultimately with a Cape to Cairo railway. We started talking on Rhodes a few months back. Another station, you remember, showed a special on him. Rhodes inspired devoted support for his goals from others in South Africa and in England, with financial support from Lord Rothschild and Alfred Beit. He was able to monopolize the diamond mines of South Africa as De Beers Consolidated Mines and to build up a great gold mining enterprise as Consolidated Gold Fields. In the middle 1890s, you know what a dollar was worth then? Lots, 1890. And a pound sterling was worth five of those in those days. In the middle 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million sterling a year, and no income tax. Then about $5 million, which was spent so freely for his mysterious purposes that he was usually overdrawn on his account. These purposes centered on his desire to federate the English-speaking peoples and bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. For this purpose, you didn't know this either. I mean, tell me something more honorable that the news media picks up. I mean, I got a scholarship at Stanford, and I didn't hear about that on the news. But somebody gives Rhodes scholarship a special premium. I mean, you can go to a junk shack, a tar paper with a television aerial on the front of it, a junk car in front. They know what a Rhodes Scholarship is. They may not know what it is, but they know it's good. It's got the aura about it. For this purpose, Rhodes left part of his fortune to found the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford in order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. You now know why the elitists of this world want to control education. And I'm going to have something to say about that in the days ahead. You now know why that the government has fought the churches on their schools. They want the brains. They fill the endowed chairs, the hero images in school that shapes the minds. One lecture by Ruskin did this to Rhodes. That's why I said I'd like to have Bible students like that. Some of you want me to answer every question in just one night so you can go watch one of those other pogo stick Christianity stations. Jump up and down a while. How about getting a tape of one of the messages and writing it out in longhand? Then I'll really believe you're serious. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples, now watch a chain reaction. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples at Oxford were a group of intimate friends, including, listen to these names, Arnold Toynbee, Alfred, later Lord Milner, Arthur Glazebrook, George, later Sir George Parkin, Philip Littleton Jell, and Henry, later Sir Henry Birchenough. These were so moved by Ruskin, as Cecil Rhodes had been, that they devoted the rest of their lives to carrying out his ideas. A similar group of Cambridge men, including Reginald Balliol Brett, Lord Esher, Sir John B. Seeley, Albert Lord Grey, and Edmund Garrett, were also aroused by Ruskin's message and devoted their lives to extension of the British Empire and uplift of England's urban masses as two parts of one project they called the Extension of the English-Speaking Idea. They were remarkably successful in these aims because England's most sensational journalist, see the tools they use? University, journalism. England's most sensational journalist, William T. Stead, an ardent social reformer and imperialist, brought them into association with Rhodes. This association was formally established on February 5, 1891, when Rhodes and Stead organized a secret society of which Rhodes had been dreaming for 16 years. You better elect a politician that knows what's going on in the world. Ideals are worthless if you don't know who's pulling the strings. Rhodes, this association was formally established on February 5th, 1891. Here are the roots, all I'm saying. Here are the roots of what I read earlier, or said earlier, of what came out at Jekyll Island, 1911. They won the battle, and they've been in control ever since. Republican Party. One year, they were supporting both Teddy Roosevelt and his opponent. Jimmy Carter was their puppet. He was too dumb to pull it off right. Grinning Baptist. More teeth than brains. So they had to back off from him and put the present vice president, check his CFR linkage, a heartbeat from Reagan's seat. And if Reagan can pull off what he ideally wants, be like a rock in the Atlantic. It might shake some plankton for a few feet, but the whales won't even hear it. The association was established February 5th, 1891. You say, what can you do about it? There's one power they don't have a corner on, they don't control, God. There is one group of voices they can't control, God's men. And I've got some Christians out there, milquetoast, bound in your little fence, bootlicking Antichrist predecessors that think I'm bad because I call them jackasses. I don't know, you guys, hey, you act like you never heard me call anybody a jackass before. Rhodes had dreamed of it for 16 years in this, underline the word, secret society. See, this guy, he blew it. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be the leader. Stead, Brett, Lord Escher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. Why do you think they don't like a church that will delegate power to a pastor? They know the surest way in the world to get a mess is let a committee do it. Why do you think they hate a church that says, no, no, we won't show? They want to have a corner on the only secrets, theirs. They can go to hell. Oh, he did it again. No, I'm just saying they go where they want to go. I'm not going to fight it. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be the leader. Wonder who elected him. Milner, Lord Escher, and Stead, the executive committee, Arthur, Lord Balfour. You know him? Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert, Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a, quote, circle of initiates. While there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers. This outer circle, dummies, I got an invitation to it once when I was in university. They think they're really, they're like, you know, I remember a pastor I used to work for. He used to have a board, he said, you know, and he had a reputation in ministers' groups around the country as being a team man. He'd laugh at me and say that he'd go to board meetings and they would think they came up with the idea, but he did the homework before they got there, and those poor stoops thought they thought it up. I said to him, oh, blank, blank, I called him his name. I said, that's an insult. I mean, if it's going to be a joint decision, then let it be a joint decision. If they're just going to advise you, you ought to have enough chemistry in your brain to let truth influence you, but don't insult them. Tell them they're advising. You're going to make the decision if it's your responsibility. But some people love the little ego trip. We got to vote that everybody can go to the toilet once in a while. You should never separate authority and responsibility, and these people knew that. That round table was not the inner circle. They didn't control the money. They were an association of helpers. Later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization. By the way, nobody votes to go to the restroom here. You only get to go when I say go. Till I go, don't you dare go to the bathroom at home. You sit right there and listen to me. New people don't believe I'm serious. That's terrible. Brett was invited to join this organization the same day, and Milner a couple of weeks later on his return from Egypt. Both accepted with enthusiasm. Later to become roundtable societies throughout the Commonwealth, including the United States, to spawn CFR, the elite brain trust of this nation that produces most of the bureaucracy that makes the decisions in Washington, the in crowd that dominates universities, press, media, And what do some monkey like me? That's their view. I proved them the monkeys, which they are. Missing link. Thus, the central part of the secret society was established by March 1891. That's that group that he said had been running the world. He continued to function as a formal group, although the outer circle was apparently not organized until 1909 to 1913. This group was able to get access to Rhodes' money after his death in 1902 and also to the funds of loyal Rhodes supporters like Alfred Beat and Sir Abe Bailey. With this backing, they sought to extend and execute the ideals that Rhodes had obtained. You know, poor old Hunt, they thought they'd corner the silver market. They didn't belong to this crowd. And they got set up. And I got some advice for Hunt and his crowd that listen. They better start backing some rebels instead of some of these glitter-teeth Christian people that try to make peace with their enemies. If you don't know who the Antichrist is and his appearance, God help you. With this backing, they extended the ideals that Rhodes had obtained from Ruskin and Steed. Milner was the chief Rhodes trustee, Parkin the organizing secretary of the Rhodes Trust after 1902, while Gell and Birchenough, as well as others with similar ideas, became officials of the British South Africa Company. And we have government officials worrying about a church that brings together people with common ideas. They have already seen the power of such organization, because that's the way they operate. I said to somebody today what I've said to you, the world's attitude of the ministry would be, if you're smart enough to do something like this, you're smart enough to know there isn't any such thing as miracles and supernatural happenings. And the only people they want in the ministry or a Christian is somebody so dumb you can never figure out what they're doing. And churches that stay in their box and never disturb anybody. They were joined in their efforts and by other Ruskinite friends like Lord Grey, Lord Escher, and Flora Shaw, later Lady Lugard. In 1890, by a stratagem too elaborate to describe here, see, he doesn't tell everything, Miss Shaw became the head of the colonial department of the Times, while still remaining on the payroll of Stead's Pall Mall Gazette. The dominant English-speaking voice in the world in that day. In this post, she played a major role in the next 10 years in carrying into execution the imperial schemes of Cecil Rhodes, to whom Stead had introduced her in 1889. Hey, this is no Bircher. This is one of their crowd describing it, to their dismay. In the meantime, in 1884, acting under Ruskin's inspiration, a group which included Arnold Toynbee, Milner, Gell, Gray, Seeley, Michael Glazebrook, founded the First Settlement House, an organization by which educated upper-class people could live in the slums in order to assist, instruct, and guide the poor, with particular emphasis on social welfare and adult education. The new enterprise, set up in East London with P.L. Gell as chairman, was named Toynbee Hall after Arnold Toynbee. Now watch that technique of association that inflates the ego. They get every single learned brain in their crowd that they can. This was the original model for the thousands of settlement houses, such as Hull House in Chicago, now found throughout the world, and was one of the seeds from which the modern movement for adult education and university extension grew. No wonder they don't want the churches to meddle in that area. As Governor General and High Commissioner of South Africa, in the period 1897 to 1905, Milner recruited a group of young men, chiefly from Oxford and from Toynbee Hall, to assist him in organizing his administration. Through his influence, why do you think I won't let them know off payroll records who my interns are? What we do as a church and who you are, boy, would they like to have a list of the donors of this church. Through his influence, these men were able to win influential posts in government and international finance and become the dominant influence in British imperial and foreign affairs up to 1939. Under Milner, in South Africa, they were known as Milner's Kindergarten until 1910. In 1909 to 1913, they organized semi-secret groups known as roundtable groups in the chief British dependencies and the United States. These still function in 8 countries. They kept in touch with each other by personal correspondence, frequent visits, and through an influential quarterly magazine, The Round Table, founded in 1910, largely supported by Sir A. Bailey's money. In 1919, they founded the Royal Institute of International Affairs, for which the chief financial supporters were Sir A. Bailey and the Astor family, owners of the Times. Similar institutes of international affairs were established in the chief British dominions and in the United States, where it is known as the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. They have dominated foreign policy of these United States that has sold us down the river for the last several presidencies, over the last 20 years. Their chief darling and mouthpiece, his godship Kissinger. Similar institutes of international affairs in the United States, where it's known as the Council on Foreign Relations. After 1925, a somewhat similar structure of organizations, known as the Institute of Pacific Relations, was set up in 12 countries holding territory in the Pacific area. The units in each British dominion existing on an interlocking basis, with the Round Table Group and the Royal Institute of International Affairs in the same country. In Canada, the nucleus of this group consisted of Milner's undergraduate friends at Oxford. If a pastor of a church would practice such nepotism with friends and relatives, the Attorney General would try to put him in jail. While in South Africa and India, the nucleus was made up of former members of Milner's Kindergarten. The groups in Australia and New Zealand had been recruited by Stead through his magazine, The Review of Reviews, as early as 1893, by Parkin at Milner instigation in the period 1889 to 1910, and by Lionel Curtis at Milner's request, 1910 to 1919. The power and influence of this Rhodes Milner group in British imperial affairs and in foreign policy since 1889, although not widely recognized, can hardly be exaggerated. And the dumb Argentines thought the United States might side with them? We might mention as an example that this group dominated the Times from 1890 to 1912 and has controlled it completely since 1912, except for the years 1919 to 22. Because the Times has been owned by the Astor family since 1922, this Rhodes Milner group was sometimes spoken of as the Clevedon set, named after the Astor country house where they sometimes assembled. Numerous other papers and journals have been under the control or influence of this group since 1889. They have also established and influenced numerous university and other chairs of imperial affairs and international relationships. Some of these are the Bate Chairs at Oxford, the Montague Burton Chair at Oxford, the Rhodes Chair at London, the Stevenson Chair at Chatham House, the Wilson Chair at Aberystwyth, and others, as well as such important sources of influence as Rhodes House at Oxford. From 1884 to about 1915, now we're in the period of 1911 when they ended up at Jekyll Island, the members of this group worked valiantly to extend the British Empire and to organize it in a federal system. You see, Jefferson and Jackson, those hard heads, believed in this country. They didn't give a hoot or holler about coordinating with these international banking families. This group never let up. They were constantly harping on the lessons to be learned from the failure of the American Revolution. Hard heads. They overplayed their hand there. And the success of the Canadian Federation of 1867, and hoped to federate the various parts of the empire as seemed feasible, then confederate the whole of it with the United Kingdom into a single organization. They also hoped to bring the United States into this organization to whatever degree was possible. Go to a library if you can, find everything you can on the Pilgrim Society. That's the most secret of the ones in the United States. One dedicated goal, to bring America and the United States back together again. Stead was able to get Rhodes to accept in principle a solution which might have made Washington the capital of the whole organization. The varied character of the British imperial possessions, the backwardness of many of the native peoples involved, the independence of many of the white colonists overseas, and the growing international tension which culminated in the First World War made it impossible to carry out the plan for imperial federation, although five colonies in Australia were joined in the Commonwealth of Australia in 1901, four colonies in South Africa, the Union of South Africa in 1910. Am I boring you? The making of the Commonwealth. As soon as South Africa united in 1910, the kindergarten returned to London to try to federate the whole empire by the same methods. They were in a hurry to achieve this before the war with Germany, which they believed to be approaching. I mean, if you're going to play both ends against the middle, you've got to get it organized. With Abe Bailey money, they founded the Round Table under Kerr's editorialship, met in formal conclaves, presided over by Milner to decide the fate of the empire. A handful of men playing chess with the world recruited new members to their group, chiefly from New College, of which Milner was a fellow. The new recruits included the historian, F.S. Oliver, Sir Alfred Zimmern, Sir Reginald Coupland, Lord Lovett, and Waldorf Lord Astor, or Waldorf Lord Astor. Curtis and others were sent around the world to organize round table groups in the chief British dependencies and to get them in the United States. For several years, they worked desperately to find an acceptable formula for federating the empire. Three books and many articles emerged from these discussions. Finally, it became clear the federation was not acceptable, so they went underground. It changed the idea of the British Empire to Commonwealth of Nations. During the decade 1919, and they got the Federal Reserve Board in the United States, appearing to be government-controlled, in fact, privately controlled. Reagan can't do a thing about Vogler. God's got to take him home. Wherever that is. During this decade, 1919 to 29, the Rhodes-Milner Group gave the chief impetus toward transforming the British Empire into a commonwealth and launching India on the road to self-government. The creation of the roundtable groups by Milner's kindergarten opened a new day in both these fields during 1909 to 1913, although the whole group was so secretive that even today, except for this nut, even today, many close students, by nut, he no nut, he's brilliant. But, I mean, in their view, they must feel he's a nut for blowing their cover. The group was so secretive that even today, many close students of the subject are not aware of its significance. These men had formed their intellectual growth at Oxford on Pericles' funeral oration as described in a book by a member of the group, Alfred Zimmern's The Greek Commonwealth. That's why it's been so hard to break the bondage of that Greco-Roman central view of history that I've been talking about, that archaeology has blown asunder with the dig since the mid-1800s. They had a corner on the brain trust. They cut their teeth and growth on Edmund Burke's on conciliation with America, on Sir J.B. Seeley's growth of British policy, on A.B. Dicey's The Law and Custom of the Constitution, and Lionel Curtis, who finally gave it its moral impetus, the New Testament's Sermon on the Mount. Lionel Curtis was so influenced by this, he had a fanatical conviction that the proper spirit with it and the proper organization, local self-government and federalism, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. Now, listen to me. I got Christian evangelicals listening to me by the thousands that don't even know they're duped and still made the puppets of liberalism. In basic understanding, the neo-Orthodox theologians criticized by many fundamentalists have got a better grip on the truth of God's Word and what's going on than some evangelicals that parrot hatred of liberalism and serve its ends. Neo-Orthodoxy was born in the voices of Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich, and Reinhold Niebuhr. They were thoroughgoing liberalists that had the liberal philosophy blown asunder because they were basically honest enough men to see its fallacy. Liberalism had a simple philosophy. Sin was ignorance, salvation was education, and the ethic of Jesus, practiced by learned good men, would usher in the millennium on earth. Some of you amillennialists still don't know where your theories come from. The fundamental difference between Christianity and every other founded religion, Jesus did not preach an ethic apart from himself. He poked holes in the Pharisaical deficient understanding of God's standard that he might do what Paul said the law was designed to do, and Christ was the law fulfilled. Its purpose is to be a schoolmaster, to make a lie of what the devil told Adam and Eve, that namely knowledge, eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, could enable them to become like God. And that's been Satan's message from day one. Knowledge of good and evil, once you got it, you can be like God. And they believe Satan, disbelieve God, and God's been in the business from chapter 1 after that fall of man to the present to teach that Satan lied. He's not only teaching that what God said is true, man will die. He's also teaching that what Satan said is a lie. Knowledge will not give you godness. And the purpose of the law is to teach that lesson. The law is a schoolmaster, including Jesus' own example. The New Testament says we fall short of the glory of God. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and the glory of God is Christ. And His nature expressed through His Spirit. Many of you have salivated over Charles Sheldon's In His Steps. Ask the question for your life, what would Jesus do? Raw, damnable, heretical modernism, liberal theology. Scripturally, totally unsound, and yet I've got some milquetoast Christians so broad-minded they think there's a flat-headed, they don't know when the world's walking on them. You don't ask what would Jesus do, you ask what he'd have you do. Doing what Jesus would do would be seek a crucifixion, get nailed on a tree, and be as idiotic as the Catholic penance program. You nail you or me to all the trees in the world, and we wouldn't save a mosquito. Only Christ could die for the world. He came to do what only He could do in God's redemptive plan, and the body of Christ teaches there'll never be another you. And He has something for me and you to do, not what He did. He did His job and finished it. And the imitation of Christ is a liberal concept. It puts Christ on the plane with other great religious teachers who's taught an ethic. Buddha, when he was dying, said, I'm not worthy to lead the work. All I leave you is the way. It worked for me. You do it. The Eightfold Path. Muhammad did not claim to be divine. He got a vision from Allah, one God. Muhammad's his prophet. And they put Christ in the same camp, another prophet. Jesus came preaching himself. He said, I'm the door, I'm the way, I'm the light, I'm the water. By me if any man enter in. Forsake all and come after me. Make me your master. The literal substance of spirit life possessing. And as Tozer says, we don't need spiritual imitation, we need spiritual fruition, which comes about in the life of faith, not imitation of liberalistic ideas of love. And they got you turning your cheek like a revolving door while they walk on you. Liberalism. Lionel Curtis had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and proper organization, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. And from the Sermon on the Mount, they set up the ideal church, the ideal clerical attitude, the ideal Christian performance, and they found the gloss over covering for their damnable elitist desire to rule the world in their image. They were the do-gooders. They sit on the top of the heap. And the rest of the world is, by them, managed into do-good attitudes, do-good works, and run up. If everybody did what Charles Sheldon said a Christian would do, you'd go to the slums. I washed up the same drunk week after week after week in Oroville until I finally figured out he'd come to me and play at being a Christian till he got what I had and off for another drunk. I think I got saved when I kicked his rear end the last time. The Sermon on the Mount was never designed by God to be performed by man. If you believe it was, you don't understand Paul at all. It was designed finally to teach as a schoolmaster the sheer and utter impossibility of man measuring up to God's true standard, and only an implant of God's Spirit, new life in man, could pick man up, and only God can be like God. Man can never do it, and the devil is made the liar. Liberalism preached ethical Christianity. The social gospel became the surface out-voiced speech of this controlling group, and that's where the media picked it up. The only preacher the media will make a hero out of is a social gospel preacher. The only thing they want to see church money go for is charitable acts. God took care of charity by telling them how to glean in the field. Giving to God was insanity from a humanistic charitable frame. You took the best you had and took it behind a closed door and burned it. If there were 1,000 people on the edge of the camp starving to death, you took the best cow and you burned it. And the word was a worshipful word, meaning to ascend to God alone. But with the New Testament Sermon on the Mount as the rallying cry to justify their dastardly deeds, to spread the gospel of the kingdom, do-goodism, and they've done their job, hiding on the mountain of their millions in the name of the Sermon on the Mount, social welfare that they don't pay for, we pay for with our taxes, became the norm. He had this fanatical conviction. He was sure that if people were trusted just a bit beyond, get rid of our weapons and trust the communist. If people were trusted just a bit beyond what they deserve, they would respond by proving worthy of such trust. I tried that. As he wrote in The Problem of the Commonwealth, if political power is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. Seen that in the world today? This was the spirit which the Milner's group tried to use toward the Boers. The Australians are coming out with some good movies to show who the scapegoats of that idiot war was. This point of view was in Curtis' 3 volumes on world history. In the case of Hitler, at least, these high ideals led to disaster. This seems also to be the case in South Africa. A Christian concept. He held that men should strive to build the kingdom of heaven here upon this earth. Isn't that what? Look, the leaders of this world think we can figure out how to establish peace. Look at the members of this group at the League of Nations. Go down the roster of United Nations. Go get somebody to do a title report on where the land came from and which offices are across the street. And who runs it? He held that men should strive to build the kingdom of heaven here upon this earth, and that the leadership in that task must fall first and foremost upon the English-speaking peoples. In this spirit, the Rhodes-Milner group tried to draw plans for the Federation, as I've said. They had to give up on that and go secret. I could now go to some of the people who moved in. B.K. Long, South African Roundtable Group, was the colonial editor of the Times, editor of Rhodes' paper, the Cape Times. An imperial conference was convoked by Milner. The ideas were then formulated by John W. Defoe, editor of the Winnipeg Free Press for 43 years. Defoe persuaded the Canadian Prime Minister, Sir Robert Borden, to accept his ideas and then brought in Long and Dawson, editor of the Times. You want to know the newspapers and the magazines and the television stations that they control, and the airlines, and that Dutch meeting of financiers every year? Would you like to know who controls all of these and which ones they control? Huh? I got to fold it down right here. But you got to talk to me a while. I got it dog-eared. Hey, you out there or not? The significant influence of Wall Street. This is the guy who said it, meaning Morgan. Old JP, it was his secret train they crawled in. Both in the Ivy League and in Washington. He must have been one of the ugliest men the world ever produced. In the period of 60 or more years following 1880, explains the constant interchange between the Ivy League and the federal government. I mean, they just spew them out of Georgetown and spew them out of Harvard and spew them out of Princeton and put them there to fight Scott because I can't be bought. You take care of me. An interchange which undoubtedly aroused a good deal of resentment in less favored circles. Contempt by me, who were more than satiated with the accents, tweeds, and high episcopal Anglophilia of these peoples. Poor Dean Acheson, in spite of or perhaps because of his remarkable qualities of intellect and character, took the full brunt of this resentment from McCarthy and his allies in 1948 to 54. The same feeling did no good to pseudo-Ivy League figures like Alger Hiss. You ever wondered why some of these guys end up, when they get caught, appointed to some world social organization? Because of its dominant position in Wall Street, the Morgan firm came also to dominate other Wall Street powers. such as Carnegie, Whitney, Vanderbilt, Brown Harriman, or Dillon Reed. Close alliances were made with Rockefeller, Mellon, and Duke interests, but not nearly so intimate ones with the great industrial powers like DuPont and Ford. In spite of the great influence of this Wall Street alignment, an influence great enough to merit the name of the American establishment, this group could not control yet the federal government, and in consequence had to adjust to a good many government actions thoroughly distasteful to the group. The insider ought to know. The chief of these were in taxation law. They wanted the income tax, but the inheritance tax bothered them. These tax laws drove the great private fortunes dominated by Wall Street into tax-exempt foundations. They want to know every donor to this little church and what each donor gives and what each individual donation is spent for. There have been a few politicians whose careers ended when they tried to investigate in depth these private foundations. The private fortunes were driven into tax-exempt foundations, which became a major link in the establishment network between Wall Street, the Ivy League, and the federal government. Dean Rusk, Secretary of State after 1961, formerly President of the Rockefeller Foundation and Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, I'm on page 938. Is as much a member of this nexus as Alger Hiss, the Dulles brothers, Jerome Green, James T. Shotwell, John W. Davis, Elihu Root, and Philip Jessup. More than 50 years ago, the Morgan firm decided to infiltrate the left-wing political movements in the United States. This was relatively easy to do. You know, let them do the thing, just infiltrate them and dominate them. Since these groups were starved for funds and eager for a voice to reach the people, Wall Street supplied both. This is the way they operate. The purpose was not to destroy, dominate, or take over, but really threefold. To keep informed about the thinking of left-wing or liberal groups, to provide them with a mouthpiece so they could blow off steam, and three, to have a final veto on their publicity and possibly on their actions if they ever went too radical. The best example of this alliance of Wall Street and left-wing publications was the New Republic, a magazine founded by Willard Strait using Payne Whitney money. In 1914, Strait, who had been assistant to Sir Robert Hart, director of Chinese Imperial Customs Service and head of the European imperialistic penetration of China, had remained in the Far East, became a Morgan partner and the firm's chief expert on the Far East. He married Dorothy Payne Whitney, whose names indicate the family alliance of two of America's greatest fortunes. She was the daughter of William C. Whitney, New York utility millionaire, and the sister and co-heiress of Oliver Payne of Standard Oil Trust. One of her brothers married Gertrude Vanderbilt, while the other, Payne Whitney, married the daughter of Secretary of State John Hay, who enunciated the American policy of the open door in China. In the next generation, three first cousins, John Hay, Jock Whitney, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Sonny Whitney, and Michael Whitney, Mike Strait, were allied in numerous public policy enterprises of a propagandist nature. And all three served in varied roles in the late New Deal and Truman. Hey, this isn't an enemy. There's an insider ratting on them, tying together the hidden connections. In the late New Deal and Truman administrations, in these they were closely allied with other Wall Street liberals such as Nixon Rockefeller. The New Republic was founded by Willard and Dorothy Strait using her money and continued to be supported by her financial contributions until March 23, 1953. The original purpose for establishing the paper was to provide an outlet for the progressive left and to guide it quietly in the Anglophile direction. Whatever's happening, they're above it all. They're going to manipulate everybody. This latter task was entrusted to a young man only 4 years out of Harvard, but already a member of the mysterious roundtable group, which had played a major role in directing England's foreign policy since its formal establishment in 1909. Now, you're going to wonder why this man has become the absolute God image hero for journalists. Images are made in America. Who's that recently died actor? A genius actor that plays that gardener that becomes Peter Sellers. What's the name of the movie? Being There. He doesn't even have a name. They think his name is Gardner. Becomes advisor to the president. And they only, when they get done image making him, he can walk on water. Listen to this. Here is the dean. They call him the dean of American journalists. Look who he represents. This new recruit, Walter Lippmann, has been from 1914 to the present the authentic spokesman in American journalism for the establishments on both sides of the Atlantic and international affairs. I told you I was going to tell you where it goes from here. Three pages, plus a couple other sections of this book that tells you what you read every time you get on airplanes and who controls them. But it's 10:25. I'll just dog-ear that. See you next week, or next month, or next year. You understand? Now, God's in control. That's what I preached this morning. But there is a movement. Satan gives it its impetus. The spirit of Antichrist. What does Antichrist mean? You're nutty in a fruitcake if you think Antichrist will be recognized because of his instant opposition to God. It's a false prophet preaching religion that gets you to bow down to him. Antichrist means substitute deliverer. Here are the forerunners building on liberal Sermon on the Mount, gushy, gushy, sloppy, agape, grinning, glitter teeth, goofy Christianity. Lay down, be walked on. Well, they don't just walk on you, they run their carriage over you. Wake up. Why, I founded Cuss You University. Come on, United States, stand up. Sammy, will you come and bring somebody and sing, I'm going through. And I'm going home. I'll finish this. I mean, between the pyramids and the eels and the 10 tribes and Genesis through Revelations and 1,348 pages of Quigley, we got plenty to do till Jesus comes. Those creeps, they're worse than the FCC. They are the FCC. They control it, except for you and me and others like us. Why do you think they'd spend millions of dollars to shut up this little station so they can give it to somebody to show pornographic movies? It's a voice they can't control. I don't have a premium on it. I just happen to be here where I can be heard. There are lots of people who know the truth of what I'm saying. But let nobody disguise the truth. The reason they'll take discarded, excommunicated crooks of various kinds from religious organizations and turn them into saints so they can destroy a free voice of God. God they can't control, and Antichrist can't come to power until the church is removed. And we're doing our little bit to restrain his coming while we wait for our Lord's coming. We made it through 1982, and I'm going through, and I'll see you tomorrow night, 8 o'clock.